This podcast is Entail Enhanced. To see pictures, articles, and links of what's being discussed, download the Entail app.
Hi, I'm Archul, YouTuber, Instagrammer, a real voice for the brown girls, and now your girl's an author. Yes, that is right. Pre-orders for What Would the Auntie Say, the book, are now available on Waterstones, WH Smith, Amazon, and other major book retailers. Join me and some very special guests where we discuss taboo subjects and really give the aunties something to talk about. In today's episode, I'm joined by Dr. Reenie Singh as we discuss how to handle the in-laws, whether you should live with them after marriage, and how to set boundaries with them. Plus, so much more. I know that this is a tricky subject for many, so I really hope you're able to take something away from this episode. I know I did. Enjoy. So could I just firstly ask you to start off by introducing yourself?
Sure. So my name is Reenie, Dr. Reenie Singh, but I often ask my clients and students to just call me Reenie because it's more informal. So please do that too. Yeah. And I'm a couples and families systemic psychotherapist with coming up to 30 years of clinical experience. Wow. Working with children, families, couples, especially intercultural couples, and individuals of all ages. And so I've been doing this for a while. I'm also a psychologist by background. And at the moment, I work at a place called the Child and Family Practice, where I've set up a center for intercultural couples about 5 years ago. And I'm also the author of 4 books and numerous articles. And I love teaching and speaking for the media. So I do this as well, all over the world.
So basically, you are multifaceted. You have all these sort of credentials and all sorts. I mean, what don't you do?
A lot of things. Technology, one of them.
You're all good. Could you tell me how you got into this industry?
Well, it's an interesting question. I mean, I guess I became a psychologist because I was just quite a keen observer of relationships, especially within my family as I was growing up. Mm-hmm. And when I told my parents that I wanted to study psychology, my mother was horrified and she said, all psychologists are mad. And now realize that she might have had a point. But in terms of couple relationships, that's more recent, you know. So I studied psychology and then I studied family therapy for a long time and worked at a place called the Tavistock, which is really quite well known. And it was great. And I really, really enjoyed it. But in terms of my couples work, I kind of came out from working at the Tavi and set up my own independent practice and noticed that I'd get lots of referrals from couples and that many of them were from different cultural backgrounds and that I didn't really have the tools and, you know, the sort of more traditional psychology, counseling, psychotherapy, family therapy that I had studied had not really equipped me with the tools to know how to work with these couples. And at the same time, in my own intercultural couple relationship, I was also struggling and not being able to pinpoint what it was that the issues were. And this led me to start reading, researching, thinking, working with this particular client group, which is a group that I'm most interested in. And I guess as part of that group, I've really become interested in how couples negotiate relationships with extended families, especially when they're from different religious backgrounds. So I've been thinking a lot about cultural differences and similarities and how to work with different minority ethnic groups, because I get referrals, especially now with the whole pandemic and the fact that we're all working on Zoom. I get referrals from all over the world, which is really exciting and a wonderful opportunity. And it also teaches me a lot about how different cultures, different religions, different faiths do coupleness and how it's different and family relationships, how they're different.
Yeah, that's actually so interesting, like being able to deal with different backgrounds. And you must find that there are sometimes a lot of similarities and some things that are really different. But just going back to yourself, and you said about you noticed things as you were growing up, which led you to want to be a psychotherapist. Would you mind telling me in particular what it was that you noticed, or was it something to do with your upbringing that you felt like it was pushing you in that direction?
I think what I noticed, now looking back, what I noticed, a couple of things that struck me the most One is just how difficult it is for couples to negotiate difference. And my parents, I grew up in India, and my parents were from different communities and different backgrounds, different religions. So my mm-hmm. mother is from Sindh, Hyderabad, Sindh, and my father is Punjabi Sikh. And although, you know, nowadays it doesn't seem like such a big deal, I think in India these differences are still really huge, you know.
Yeah.
To marry outside your faith background is still quite a big deal.
Yeah.
And it certainly wasn't in that day and time. So I think what I found is what it means for couples to come from different backgrounds. For my father, he had been cut off from his own family. Okay. For cutting his hair. So he was from a Sikh background. And I think that, you know, so talk about in-law relationships and extended family relationships, my mother had none. Mm-hmm. And I think for my dad, it was a lot of loss. That actually, I think he suffered from mental health issues, a lot of depression, a lot of cultural bereavement. And I think, you know, observing that as a child, I think led me to believe in the importance of extended families and the importance of what it means to not to be a part of your own family and faith and to be distanced from that. So I think that was one of the things that I really sort of noticed. And the other sort of huge experience I had in terms of being a psychotherapist and struggling with these issues is when I came to the UK sort of in my early 30s, so a while ago now, and found that some of the sort of models that were used in my clinical training didn't fit in with my understanding of Indian family systems.
Right.
So it seemed quite alien. I mean, simple things like my whole peer group and supervisor would be horrified if the child, I remember there was a child, adolescent actually, of about 11, who was sleeping in his parents' bed.
Okay.
And everyone was up in arms and they said, this is terrible and we have to report this to social services. For us, having grown up in India, me and my other Indian colleagues and friends, this just wasn't a big deal. So that really made me think about cultural differences. And I guess that kind of made me follow the track of my doctoral research, which was really about how families are constructed differently in different cultures.
Yes.
And hence my interest in cultural difference and psychotherapy models and how they fit or don't fit. And that really has been my passion and my research interest.
It's so interesting how things that happen as a small child and just small things that you may notice lead you down this path to have such an amazing career and passion. So yeah, that is really, really interesting to hear. And today, I really want to focus more so on the relationships between in-laws and dealing with in-laws, because I get tons of messages from lots of young brown women or brown girls, and you know, I've noticed it myself with my sisters, where there's always some sort of difficulty with your in-laws. And me personally, my only experience with in-laws is my brother-in-law or my sister-in-law's, but I don't have like actual, I mean, I'm not married, so I don't have to deal with that drama so myself. But you know, me sort of sitting on the outside and watching in, it looks really sort of scary. And you must deal with a lot So I'd love for you to just talk to me about some of the problems that people come to you with when they're dealing with their in-laws.
Well, I think that, you know, first of all, I just want to say personally that I've had really good relationships with my in-laws. So I do feel that when young women talk to me about in-law problems, I usually also draw on my own experiences, which have been positive.
Yeah.
I do realize that not all in-laws are the same. And some in-laws can be quite interfering and quite intrusive.
Mm.
And certainly with many of my clients, one of the first things I do is to try and help them to establish some boundaries, you know.
Yes.
Boundaries around parenting, boundaries around their couple relationship. And I think in the South Asian context, this is really, really difficult, because I think a lot of in-laws assume that, you know, the daughter-in-law will just be kind of subsumed into that family system.
Yes.
And they really don't allow space, you know, and they'll kind of, I've had clients where, you know, they'll kind of come into the home unannounced, especially if everybody sort of lives on the same street or they live close by together. They'll sort of always think that one home is the same as the other homes, you know. So they won't make any effort to respect individuality or even space.
Yeah.
concept.
Privacy.
Privacy, yeah. The concept of that just doesn't seem to exist in the Asian context. And so what I do, especially with the women, is I try to get them to, with the support of their husbands, either through a couple session, or a series of couple sessions, or if the husband doesn't want to attend, then even just with the woman by herself, to actually help her to become more assertive and to put down those boundaries. Because I think that there's a danger that if she doesn't, then she can become really resentful and really, really angry. And the children can get terribly confused as well. You know, maybe going to their grandmother or to their bua for asking for something. Or should they actually be approaching their parents and asking for something? So I think it's really important to be clear about the boundaries and to help women to do that.
I completely agree. I think that if you don't set those boundaries sort of from the get-go, from the beginning, you're only going to... The tension, basically, is only just going to keep building and building and building. And, you know, the parent-in-laws have an expectation of a daughter-in-law and... I do see it from a daughter-in-law perspective where it's really challenging. How do you go in there and just say, these are my boundaries? And obviously, I don't think that anyone should go in there and have a conversation aggressively. You know, everything should be said out of love and respect. But I also see it, I also think that a lot of the time, the parents don't really care for these boundaries. They don't care that you are, maybe, you know, as a brown girl, you might be sensitive or you don't like this or you don't like that. They see it as you're coming into our house, you're coming into our family, and you just have to do things how we do it.
Yes. And that's why I think it has to be both, and it really has to be give and take. And if a daughter-in-law actually does learn about the family culture, that stands them in good stead. One of the things I offer is premarital counseling. It's usually for my intercultural couples. And, you know, they really sort of benefit from having a space where they can think about what the future is going to be like, you know, whether they agree about parenting rules. Now, I know it's slightly different in the Asian context because there isn't that, you know, huge need to have the premarital work because the couples assume that things are going to be okay.
Yeah.
And they usually come to me only when, you know, after they're married and they get really stuck with the in-law problems.
I mean, that's normal for most people. Like, they only think of therapy. I myself, I only think of therapy when I know things are going wrong or I'm feeling bad.
That's one of the things I'm really trying to revise, you know, and I hope that, you know, this podcast will serve that function as well, that actually therapy isn't sort of, you know, it's not just for pathology. It really is as preparation. Definitely. It's for everybody. It's for all of us to start thinking differently about our relationships, to this kind of relationship therapy. But so I do think that actually, if the couple can, either with a professional's help or even by themselves, sit down and actually talk about these issues, to how to deal with in-laws before they get married, that would really be helpful so they don't get so stuck. Actually, one of the other things that I do with women who are just going into a family as a daughter-in-law is I try and help them to map out the family. So through a cultural genogram, which is a method we use to try and understand the family map, who all are in the family.
That's interesting.
What are the hierarchies? You know, who's got the power? Who's in charge?
Wow.
Who could be their possible allies within a family system? Who are the frenemies? Who are the ones to avoid? You know? who can they actually get on their side? Because actually, you know, even in families who seem the most hostile and the most competitive, there will be at least one or two family members who would be approachable and nice and would like to make a relationship with this newcomer to the family. So it's like any organization joining a new office or something, because at one level it is a kind of job, you know?
Yeah.
And actually, the husband, one's husband or partner should be one's biggest ally.
Yes.
And if you get them on your side, then the rest of the battles don't matter so much. So that's the other thing I do with some of the young women who have in-law problems whom I work with. Try and coach them about how important it is to understand things from their husband's perspective as well. Because, you know, the husband could feel incredibly torn and does often in the midst of this. So instead of going into all the arguments and fights, how can they actually try and help their husbands to understand their struggles?
With or without my help.
How might a negative relationship with your in-laws affect your actual relationship with your partner?
Well, it does. It could have a terrible effect because, you know, as I said, the husband can feel really stuck in the middle, can feel really torn. He has all these obligations to his family, as, you know, the daughter-in-law does too, to her own family. And of course, that's the other issue that comes up. What's the relationship between the in-laws and your own one's own family? And, you know, lots of daughters-in-law feel that, you know, their own family isn't respected and their own family have a completely different way of doing things. And, yeah. and that causes a lot of stress and conflict as well with my clients. But one of the things that I do is try and help them to understand how the impact of this conflict on their husbands and how, you know, how their husbands sometimes, I think, have kind of chosen them because they're sufficiently different from the family. And so, in a way, if the husband wants some autonomy and wants some distance from his own family, then he's done this great job in marrying somebody slightly different. Or sometimes it's the opposite. The husband might be a little bit of an outlier or sometimes even a black sheep. And he wants to marry this girl who's exactly right and whom the parents adore, just to kind of become more integrated into his own family.
That's so interesting.
Yes, yes.
I never thought of it that way.
Yes. So I also help the daughter-in-law to realize what an important function she serves for her husband, for the family, what she must mean to the family, and help the husband. And if I do work with a couple that I often do around the in-law problems, I help the husband to affirm this and to affirm the wife, the new daughter-in-law, and to reassure her that she does have a really important function and that he will protect her and support her and stand up to his parents if necessary, you know, for her.
How often is it that a South Asian man will want to come in to do couples therapy? Because if I think about it, I think most of the time, and I'm generalizing and I could be so wrong here, but they might feel like, no, I can do it with, you know, without therapy. We don't need therapy. I don't need to go. Maybe you want to go. Because I think it would be really challenging to go and do couples therapy, even though it would be so, so helpful. Yeah. Like how often does it happen?
Well, I do have lots and lots of South Asian couples, so I think it's becoming a little bit more common. It's becoming a little bit more possible. I think it helps a lot that I'm South Asian, so they feel more comfortable and they feel that, you know, their concerns can be understood better. I think it might be quite difficult for a South Asian man to talk to a white British therapist about their couple relationship, but it might be the same for the woman as well. Yeah. So I think that definitely helps. You know, they will often check out whether I understand their system. Of course, nobody wants to feel judged or pathologized, you know. So it's really important for me to kind of join with them and reassure them that, you know, these problems are just quite normal and we all experience them. But I think it's difficult for men anyway to engage with couples therapy. And maybe there's an added layer of complexity for the South Asian man.
Yeah.
But again, times are changing and I'm really quite impressed by how many men of all cultures do come in for therapy and how difficult it is, but how committed they are to their couple relationships so that they do really want to do whatever it takes, really.
No, that's good to hear. I feel like there's so much pressure for these young brown women. Honestly, you must get it all the time. But the types of messages I receive feel like they're going through so much trauma or difficulty, or there are just so many expectations and standards that they have to meet. Why do you think it's like that within our culture?
Well, I think that that's partly because a lot of my South Asian clients have grown up in the Western world. So they have received one kind of story or set of messages from their upbringing in this country, usually, although I do have clients, as I said, from other countries too.
Yeah.
But even then, the younger women are kind of shaped by stories or discourses that belong to the Western world. Mm. And at the same time, when they get married, especially, there's still a lot of expectations from their own parents, from their in-laws, that belong to a more traditional way of looking at the world. So in a sense, you know, they're really in a bind because there's this dilemma about what kind of yardstick, what norms to follow. You know,
yeah.
And it can be extremely confusing and put a lot of pressure. And I should say that that's the same for men, but maybe less so, because there isn't quite the same amount of pressure. Certainly from in-laws, there isn't.
No.
No. And, you know, for women, of course, you know, especially if there's a whole sort of issue of sort of wanting to have, being expected to have children, that puts another whole level of pressure on women. But I think that this is a part of the struggle and problem, both for men and women, but more so for women, just about the sort of conflicting roles and messages that they get from the sort of more Western society and more liberal upbringing sometimes. Yeah. And then the more conservative and the more traditional. And just how to reconcile all these different ideas and messages. Mm,
definitely. I actually have three scenarios that I'm going to give you, because I think it would be really, really helpful to two people listening that are possibly going through any of these three scenarios. And I know there are so many things that go wrong, and we could literally be here all day with all these problems that everybody has. But I thought I would do three sort of common ones that I see quite often. I'd love for you to give maybe, yeah, your best advice for each scenario. What could they do in this situation? So the first one is, my mother-in-law is possessive of her son and he still feeds into it. What do I do?
So I guess what I would do if I was working with such a scenario is I would first deconstruct what possessive means in that context, you know, and normalize it as well, because actually, you know, many mothers are possessive about their sons, and that would seem quite natural. I think I would try and form a relationship with the mother-in-law in the first place, so that she feels, you know, that she feels that her son is being well taken care of, and she feels that she can relax a little bit and she doesn't need to be so possessive. And, you know, so I would actually do my best quite slowly to form a good relationship with my mother-in-law. Yeah. And of course, sometimes it's not that easy, especially if she feels jealous and she feels, you know, displaced.
Her place is being taken.
Yeah. She feels displaced. And that is quite common. In which case, I think what I would do is really then try and work mostly on my relationship with my husband and try and help him, get him on my side. As I mentioned earlier on, you know, he's my biggest ally.
Yeah.
So if he can actually talk to his mum when I'm not there, you know, and explain that she does have to let go a little bit, and to try and reassure, get the husband to actually reassure the wife that she is, you know, equally important, and to give that message to the mother, you know, get the mother to very gently and, you know, in a very respectful way, but to try and help her to back off. But actually, if I can't do that by myself, then I would get my husband to help me in this process, you know?
Yeah, it's so interesting, because I feel like most women would be taking care of their partners and they would be looking at, and but I think the way a mother wants their son to be taken care of is another level. And they forget sometimes that we too have jobs and we too just have other things to do and we have social lives. And I think they expect for the brown girls to be sort of tending to their men 24/7 and, you know, like the old school way. And it's just not like that anymore. And some of these guys, they lap it all up, because, I mean, who doesn't want the attention and who doesn't want their life made easier for them, whether it's by their mum or by their wife? So it's quite tricky.
Yes. And this is where I think that some couples therapy really comes in useful. And I'm thinking about a few couples whom I've met where actually I've worked with both the husband and the wife to help them to realize that actually, given that both of them work, you know, the husband has to be more supportive, much more helpful, much more considerate at home, do take on half the, at, you know, maybe half is kind of pushing one's luck.
No, but half is great.
Half is great. And so what I'll do is I'll sit down with a large piece of paper and plot everything that has to be done. And then get them to divide up the tasks, you know. And this, of course, has to be done without the mother-in-law being aware.
Yes, I was going
to
say.
To do all these tasks, because then it'll be like, you know, the bechara son who's being forced by this cruel dragon woman.
Yes, the evil witch of the wife. Yes.
So sometimes, unfortunately, this has to almost be hidden, you know, certainly the childcare and everything. And that's why I think the boundaries are really important. This home has to feel private, and this home has to feel like a place where the daughter-in-law is in charge, and it's her home, and it has to be run in the way in which she wants it to be. And this is actually sometimes the biggest struggle. Mm. And even if the couple, the young couple, are living in with the parents-in-law, there has to be something demarcated, whether it's a kitchen or a little space for themselves, you know, where actually their rules apply. And their rules.
This is our space and this is it. Yeah. And
these rules have to be agreed by the two of them. And so for the at the moment, for example, I'm working with a young couple who haven't had children yet, mm. where the husband expects her to go and eat with the in-laws, like practically every meal. They live around mm. the corner because that's what mummy would want. And that's how it is. And
oh,
that's
God.
One of the first. Yeah. And that's one of the first things I've done, just to help them to have their own space. It's great to go there for meals, but maybe once or twice a week. Weekends, yeah. Once I know you, even you're looking horrified. I know.
I'm like, what on earth? And also, how did you not know this before you got married? Like, surely these are conversations that need to happen beforehand.
But because she's from a different cultural background than her husband, so she didn't even expect it. It's such a shock.
You know, well, that's awful.
Culture, it would be completely different. Yes, and I agree with you that these are really important conversations to have beforehand. But if you can't, then as soon as you realize it's happening, that's when you really need to sit down with your husband and draw up, you know, even a sort of contract, if you like, or a set of rules about how to do this and how to have relationships with the extended family. And also how to have your own rules about household chores, parenting, if they have children, you know, because it doesn't feel fair, really.
Yeah.
And as you say, you know, there's so many demands and expectations on the young woman that it's really unfair.
It is unfair. Amazing. So that's scenario number one. So thanks for that. Okay, scenario number two is my husband's sister doesn't make any effort with me or can be bitchy. What can I do?
So this is another very common one.
Yeah.
As you know.
Yeah.
Again, I you know, when people present terms like possessive and bitchy, I really need to deconstruct them first. What does bitchy mean? How is it shown?
Maybe catty or, you know, like...
I do understand. I absolutely understand.
Yeah.
I do understand. And I've heard lots of stories about bitchy sisters-in-law. So I completely get it. But what I mean is, if I was working with this couple, I would ask them to interrogate what bitchiness means.
Mm, okay. And break it down, what it means to them.
Exactly. And also maybe reframe it, you know, is it bitchy or is it that this sister-in-law is feeling, again, displaced, which is, she might have had a really close relationship with her brother. She adores him. And now she feels that she's not, you know, the only one around. So maybe she's anxious, she's nervous, she feels displaced. And again, often what I'll advise my clients to do is to try and form a relationship with the sister-in-law in the first case scenario. Mm. And sometimes I know it's not possible. If they can, there might be some common interests. You know, you might want to go out and get your nails done. You might want to go out shopping, whatever you can do. You might
just
want
try
to
and
ask
do
for
something.
Her recipe. You might ask for her favorite recipe. Of course, if she's terribly bitchy, she'll leave out a couple of ingredients and give you the wrong recipe, which I've also had experience with my clients.
Really?
Well, not personal, but through my clients, I've also had experience of sisters-in-law doing that, you know? So that's terrible. And
it's just cruel.
And sometimes there is no hope, you know?
Yeah.
And if there is no hope, then again, I think one's only hope is to go through one's husband and to put those boundaries down again very firmly and clearly, so that in fact, you know, the sister-in-law has her own home. And if she's married, of course, it has a different meaning. If she's unmarried, it has a different meaning. But she has her own home, whether it's with her parents or whether it's with her own husband and children. And actually, your home is your home. And that's where you need your husband on board to realize that your family has to be your own little family unit.
And it's a priority. And how you're treated in your home is, it's priority. Like, you should be respected in your own, you should be respected in every home, but in your own home especially, it's your bubble, it's your safe space. So you shouldn't be disrespected in that space.
Absolutely. And I think that, you know, in fact, if anything, the pandemic and all the lockdown restrictions has brought this to, you know, even brought into the foreground even more. You know, sometimes the bitchiness, I think, amongst relatives will take the form of excluding some and including others. You know, there've been lots of extended families, large families I've worked with, where some people are welcome into one home, others aren't. So I guess, you know, that's another good reason for the boundaries. And actually, I think the pandemic has really helped people to realize the importance of putting that boundary very firmly, as well as being flexible. When people do observe and respect one's rules around the house.
Definitely. I actually, my sister-in-law, she moved in with us over Christmas, just for a few months while they were waiting for their house to go through because they were buying a house. And they're newlywed with my brother. And I get on really, really well with her. And obviously it was just having my brother move back in, but now with a wife, it was actually a really weird and sort of different dynamic for me. And I was not used to it whatsoever. It just felt weird. And I felt like, you know, I love her and she's going to listen to this. So she knows all of this. But like tea time at home wasn't normal tea time with my mum, because I'm sharing that time with now my sister-in-law, like whoever. And it was just a shift. And I was like, oh God, this is, you know, really different. And we actually, I'm someone that doesn't really like, I know this sounds really bad, but I hate sharing. I don't like sharing my things. And, or certain things anyway, just because I have my boundaries in the house, and I have my space, and my things that are in that space are the things that make me sort of happy, and I've worked for those things and just leave my stuff alone kind of thing. And I remember when she first moved in, she asked to borrow something, and because my answer was yeah of course. And then as it was going, like if she wanted to borrow it again and again, in my head I'm thinking, oh my God, but I haven't told her that. She doesn't know that I don't like sharing. Like my sisters know this, and my sisters will probably never ask me, and they're probably shocked that I've even said yes. But like there are certain, it's just a certain thing. So I actually, before getting really, really worked up, I went and had a conversation with her, and I said, look, I need to tell you. I just need to tell you, this is how I feel. I'd rather just get it out now, so that, like, we've never lived together. So let me just tell you how I am, and you tell me what makes you uncomfortable. And it was so much, I literally felt like a weight had been lifted off of my shoulders after that conversation. Yeah, I was like, oh God. And I said, I'm so sorry if I'm coming across as a bitch or something, or like, I don't mean to, but I just have to tell you.
And you took a risk in doing that, didn't you? And yeah. I think that's partly why it's, you know, extended families can get so complicated and difficult, because people don't take enough relational risks. And if you do, and if you do clear the air, it's actually much easier to live together.
So much easier.
And I guess your sister-in-law, maybe she came from a different kind of family.
Yeah.
Actually, you know, sharing is
great in my family. It's just me. It really is. No, everyone really is a sharer. It's just me. I think I have third child syndrome or something. So just don't like sharing.
But you know, it's good to have your own.
Yeah, it's my own stuff. I feel like that conversation, I'd never experienced anything like that. And it taught me so, I felt like a new person afterwards, because it gave me the confidence to be like, okay, maybe I don't need to people please so much, and I can sort of take this in other relationships in my life, whether it's friendships or, you know, work things.
Absolutely. I think what you did was really, really good. And I think that, you know, often I'll coach my clients to have these kinds of conversations.
It's scary.
It is scary, especially the daughters-in-law, because if you remember,
yeah,
you think about it, your sister-in-law probably feels like she has much less power than you do, because it is your own home.
Yeah.
It's kind of coming into someone else's home.
Yes.
Especially for the daughter-in-law or the sister-in-law, it's even more difficult to have these kinds of honest, risky conversations.
Definitely.
So a lot of my work is to coach them how to do it, and how to do it respectfully and politely. But, you know, to be able to go up to your sister-in-law and say, look, you know, I'm really experiencing a problem here with whatever it is. And, you know, what can we do about it?
Yeah, and
the bitchy sister-in-law is actually not so bitchy after all.
Exactly. Well, I hope not anyway. Okay, I have a third scenario for you, and this one is sort of a little bit more serious, and it's definitely one that I've had messages about before, so I thought it was important to mention. So this one is my husband has an alcohol issue and can sometimes be abusive, and his family blame me and excuse his behaviour. What can I do?
Okay, so that is really terrible, isn't it? And this is a young woman and a family that really needs help. So first of all, she can actually, you know, get like professional help, and should get professional help. And she needs to, again, make it absolutely clear that if the abuse carries on, she will, and no one protects her, she will leave.
Yeah.
And there's no reason for women to stay in abusive relationships nowadays. No. And she either needs to go back home or to a safe space. I don't know if she has children or not in this scenario. But regardless of, you know, there are all kinds of refuges and places if she doesn't have a safe space to go with her husband. But of course, the first step would be to try and get him some help and to try some professional help. I often recommend Alcoholics Anonymous and for the family members, Al-Anon, which is for families of alcoholics, so that they realize, you know. But if the husband really is alcoholic, then he needs to go through a treatment rehabilitation program, a detox program, and maybe the meetings and the therapy come later on. But it's a medical problem. There are psychiatrists who will work with these problems, but the first step is actually to get the husband to agree.
That's it. Yeah, but what I don't understand is why is there this blame culture on the girl? You know, because it is a medical issue. It is something that is within him. Maybe it's stress. Maybe it's work. Maybe it's something else. It's always an underlying issue. It should never just be from the get-go sort of blamed on the girl. And I've seen that so, so much. And it's really, really awful.
But actually what happens, if you look at it, what happens is more complex, because often the wife or the partner does get really desperate and does try and control the husband's alcoholism, which is completely understandable. And when she can't, and you know, because as you say, it's a medical problem and it's an illness, really, you know. Mm. So when she can't do anything about it, maybe out of desperation, she does, you know, try and change something. And then she gets blamed for not being able to change it and for being so nagging, with, you know, angry, yeah. Whatever. And then that can sometimes result in abuse as well.
Again, so she's then labelled the bad, evil witch again.
The bad and evil witch, because she's either caused the problem or she can't change it and can't fix it. And maybe the in-laws are not expecting their own son to take responsibility for his problem. And they're not willing to take responsibility. I've seen it with lots of families, especially in the South Asian community, but actually across the board, there are lots of families where this happens. So actually, I think that what the daughter-in-law has to do is to be extremely strong and say that, you know, unless something shifts and you guys are going to help me to take responsibility for this, I can't stay in this situation. So I think that that has to be the first step. The second step, if they agree, then to get the whole family some professional help. And it has to be professional, because otherwise nothing is going to change.
No, it's so true. It's so true. It's not like you just click your fingers and all of a sudden this kind of stops or goes away.
No. I'm sure that, you know, the daughter-in-law or the family members would have done everything that they can to try and, you know, change the person's mind, to stop them from drinking. But it's actually a waste of time, because, you know, the person is powerless over their alcohol and it is a medical problem. So it needs a medical intervention, which is usually through psychiatry, through detoxification, through rehabilitation, and then through therapy and AA meetings for the whole family. Mm. So actually, you know, but unless something shifts, I think the woman has to be quite clear that she's not going to stay in an abusive situation. And if there are children involved, they should not stay in an abusive situation either.
No.
And there are lots of agencies that help women in these sorts of situations, you know, when there's domestic violence, when there's alcoholism involved. So she should actually look up some of these agencies, organizations, and use them as a way of leaving and getting help for herself, if nothing's going to shift in the family.
Definitely, because I feel like a lot of these women sometimes feel really sort of helpless in these situations, and they feel like, as women, it is their role to either fix it or to stay, and they should, or they're going to look bad, they're going to have a bad reputation, people are going to talk about her. It's never really about him and what he's doing, it's more about her and what she isn't doing. And if she leaves, then what she's done, it's her fault.
Well, and again, a good reason why lots of South Asian women don't leave their families is because they're worried about the stigma of divorce, stigma of a single parent, if they do have children, or, you know, as you said, what people in the community are going to say about them.
Yeah.
I once worked with a mother of three, and she actually, and the husband was alcoholic and violent, and she left the home and she went to a refuge. And then when it was time for the daughters to get married, she had to come back to the husband who was really old by this time and completely alcoholic, but she had to come back to him because there's no way that anyone would have married the daughters as for her as a single parent, you know?
Oh my God.
Yes. So it's, you know, it's across the whole family life cycle, across an age range, in, you know, this kind of stigma. And I think that that is a real shame that in our community, we do that. You know, there's so much blame attached to women when it's not their fault. And so much stigma about being a single woman and a single parent.
Yeah, and there's also this huge load of pressure to almost be perfect and be the perfect daughter-in-law, be the perfect brown girl, be the good girl. But nobody's perfect. And if they look at themselves and their own families and whatnot, they're not perfect. They don't treat everyone perfectly. And I think that they have these expectations for these young girls to come into their homes and just sort of know how to do everything, know where everything goes, and knows the system of their home. And it's just so unfair.
Yes. And that's why one of the other things that I sort of help young women to do is, I think, as I mentioned, is almost to sort of do an ethnographic study, you know, try and find out more about this family. Draw a map. Yeah. Ask the husband or anyone in the family who will help them. To try and understand more, what are the rituals, what are the customs, what are the sort of joining points, you know?
Yeah.
That's
so interesting. I've never...
Rituals, yeah.
No, I might have to do it for my own family. Yes. But I feel for... we're speaking a lot about girls that are going to maybe possibly go into sort of these homes, but a lot of our listeners are probably married already, or, you know, they're either living with their in-laws or have in-laws, and they might already have sort of damaged relationships with them. And I feel like it's like what you were saying earlier about setting boundaries. It's really, really important to sort of set those boundaries early, because once you get further down the line, it's much harder to do. And especially when there's been a lot of tension or there's been arguments or everything. So yeah, it's hard to sort of come back from that. So for those that already do have slightly damaged relationships, but want to mend them, what can they do?
Well, I think you're absolutely right that they have to try much harder.
Hmm.
I think that, you know, it's never too late to do this work. I think the first step, again, has to be to try and understand the whole system much better, to try and kind of map it out, to see which relationships can be fixed and which ones can't. So I'm thinking about a client of mine who had quite troubled relationships with the whole family, and they were very possessive towards her husband, who was the oldest son, and there was no father, so he played a very important role in the family. And with her mother-in-law, I actually helped her to form some kind of relationship, because at least she felt the mother-in-law respected her a bit.
Okay.
But with a couple of the sisters-in-law, and there were, I think, two or three sisters-in-law, it wasn't possible. So sometimes you also have to cut your losses and know, you know, what you can and can't mend. And that's a lot of the work I do, trying to help young women to realize which relationships are worth mending and persevering with and which ones can't be.
Yes.
And if you do identify which ones can be mended, then it really means making an effort, you know, and a consistent and regular effort. So whether it means escorting your mother-in-law to the temple or the mosque for my Muslim clients, or, you know, just being around for her, even just once a week.
Or just calling. I feel like a picking up the phone and just calling to check in can really make a world of a difference. You really don't have to sort of move heaven and earth sometimes. You just literally have to pick up the phone.
I absolutely agree. And sometimes I'll even instruct them to sort of text or write letters, you know. Little gifts, remembering birthdays, remembering religious functions and festivals, you know, remembering things that are important to your in-law. But... So that's how you kind of build a relationship like you would with anybody, you know? And if there's a child involved, then trying to see the grandparent or the auntie or uncle. And again, doing it quite carefully and slowly and respecting your own boundaries. Because I think that sometimes, you know, young women get so angry that they forget that they actually have a lot of power and more autonomy than they think, you know? And they need to use that and to understand that actually they can say no. If the in-law kind of insists that the child go over, they can say no. So I think that the relationship that has been strained has to be rebuilt. slowly and carefully. But the first step, I think, is really sort of trying to recognize which relationships are worth rebuilding and which ones you can have much more ritualized contact with, because you need to be civil. But sometimes it's not possible in extended families to like everybody.
No, not at all. You don't even like your own family most of the time. So how can you like your in-laws, every single one of them?
No, you can't. And, you know, I think that's why this sort of idea of a map to see who your allies are, who you can get on with, who you absolutely can't, and then choose and decide where to invest your energies.
Yeah.
And, you know, sometimes it's ritualized contact, and by which I mean, you know, you can show up at a birthday or you can invite all the in-laws around for a meal now and again, but you have to know which ones actually you will go further than that. So you almost have a sort of hierarchy in your mind about which in-laws you want to get to know and be friendly with and which ones you actually don't, you know. And that's being wise and strategic, you know. It's not being, I have lots of clients and they say to me, isn't that very chalak? And I said, well, no, it's not chalak. It's being wise. It's being self-protective. It's being strategic, you know. It's knowing how to take care of yourself and your own family unit.
Yeah, I think it's about protecting yourself and also not devaluing yourself and knowing your self-worth. Like in that whole process, don't ever sort of lower yourself just to form a relationship with someone that's going to disrespect you.
And the main thing is I work with a lot of young women who end up getting terribly depressed.
Yes.
Even suffer, you know, as you know, in our South Asian communities, a lot of self-harm amongst young women, you know, and they feel very oppressed. They can feel oppressed. They can feel abused.
Yeah,
and
they feel trapped as well.
They feel trapped. So I think what you're saying is really important, to have self-worth.
Yeah.
Recognize what you're capable of. To go out into the world and engage with other things. That's the other thing, message I give a lot of young women. I know many of them work, but some don't. And then they feel even more oppressed by the in-laws, or they feel that this is their only role in life, to be a wife, to be a mother, to be a daughter-in-law. But actually, if they engage with something that they feel passionate about, if they sort of follow their own interests and their careers outside the house, then they have much, much more, they can be much more on an equal footing and they don't have to feel so devalued.
I think it's also important though that it's, I think there's nothing wrong with being a housewife or a mother or a daughter-in-law and you're at home, but only if you choose to be those things.
Absolutely, I agree. And in fact, there's a different kind of oppression where the in-laws are quite keen to send the young woman out to work and insist that she work. While they raise the children, the grandchildren, and they're still in charge, you know, they're still in charge of the homestead.
Yeah, they want control, and they want, and they want to raise your kids in their way, but that's also not fair.
Absolutely, and then I've also had clients who feel quite helpless in that role when they feel that they're being forced to work while all the parenting decisions are being made by the father and mother-in-law.
How can they manage that then?
I think that, you know, they need to work, they need to reduce their working hours then, you know, and again, this has to be done, of course, in conjunction with their husbands.
Yeah.
And maybe to seek professional help if necessary, because it can get quite treacherous. But, you know, again, they have to know their own power in the situation, because actually nobody can force anybody to either work or not work. So I really like what you said about choice. If it's their choice to raise their children and be at home, then that has to be fine. But in that case, can they engage with something else outside the home? I guess that's what I was trying to say. It doesn't have to be a paid job. In fact, it's great if they can afford not to, and if that's what you choose to do. But it has to be something that will keep them sane.
Yeah, even if it's spending a couple of hours with your friends or socializing or doing a hobby. It's so interesting. And I feel like there's this huge debate as well of whether to live with the in-laws or not to live with the in-laws. And I personally feel quite strongly, maybe because I'm not in that situation, so I can you know, sit here and say what I like, and maybe my view will change one day, but I personally feel like I strongly feel that you shouldn't live with your in-laws. I do see why, you know, in our culture, in some ways it's actually a beautiful thing that we want the new daughter to come into our home and sort of learn how the family operates and how they do things. And it is a nice thing if it's done out of, like, if you're showing her with love and not by force and
control.
And control, exactly. If you're just showing her, like, yeah, just out of love and because you want her to feel involved in your family, then that's a different thing. And obviously each family is different. And it's also nice for, you know, like someone like me who's lived with my family all my life, I don't really have to cook that much. You know, I've only just learned how to cook recently and I'm nearly 30. I don't have to really do laundry and do those types of things. So it makes sense for these brown girls that most of them have lived, you know, with their mums and dads all their lives, and then they go into someone else's home, and then somebody that new family almost teaches them how to be, you know, a wife, yeah, or a woman, and how to then look after a home.
So in those ways, when they have children,
yes,
and, you know, it's really lovely to have grandparents around,
and yes, and that support,
yeah. So I can see the value in it.
Yes. Myself,
you know, and when it works well and when it's harmonious, then it's beautiful, as you said, and it's a wonderful support system to have.
Yeah.
But I just feel that nowadays, I certainly wouldn't be able to live with a daughter-in-law. Well, maybe I would, but I don't think it would be helpful.
Do you have children yourself?
I do.
How many children do you have? Do you have sons, daughters?
I do have two sons and no daughters.
Oh my God.
One of them is old enough to be married, so I hope he does get married sometime soon.
So how would you feel about...
I don't think it's helpful nowadays, you see. I don't think it's helpful nowadays. And anyway, my oldest son doesn't live with me and hasn't from a very young age. So for him to then come home with a wife would be completely unnatural. But I do think that, you know, we all need our space nowadays. You know, we all need our autonomy. We all need our space. We all have different ways of doing things. So I actually don't feel it's that helpful to relationships to be together 24/7, you know, all living in the same house. Although, as you see, I really can see the value,
yeah.
And I think especially for younger women, as you said, to learn more about and, you know, how to run a home, how to be a mum, how to cook and to have, you know, the support. I think it's an amazing thing if it's possible. I think the ideal situation is to live close by. I do think that's ideal. And I, you know, I have lots of clients where that's what they decide to do, that they might begin by living with the family, with the in-laws. And then the minute it gets even slightly strained, they make the decision, sometimes with my help, to live close by.
Yeah.
To move out of the family home, but to live close by. And I do think that that's an ideal kind of situation.
Yeah, because you're not burning the bridge and not moving, you know, far and wide, and you're almost still saying, like, "I'm still here. We're here to support you, and hopefully you can support us."
And you have the best of both worlds, and you know, sometimes you might be in a building where you could be in a flat, you know, one flat, and there's another flat that you're in.
That's too close for me.
Yes. Well. You know, it really depends on your relationship with your in-laws.
It does.
All the in-laws. It really depends on that.
It does. And what would your expectation be for your own daughter-in-law in the future?
Yes. Well, to begin with, I don't think that, you know, I know that I would actually really respect my son's choice. So whoever he was happy with of any cultural background.
But in terms of how she is or how she comes, would you have sort of any terms of expectations or standards for her to sort of meet as a daughter-in-law?
Well, I guess I'm quite unusual, maybe, and quite different. I think my first expectation would be that she loves my son. And
I love that.
And anybody who loved him would have a special place in my heart.
This is how every mother-in-law needs to be. Like, if there are any aunties listening, please, like, we need to take a leaf out of your book.
Thank you. And, you know, and that feels quite touching even to me because I adore my sons, like every mother does.
Yeah.
But I don't feel possessive towards them. I try my best not to be possessive towards them. And, you know, if somebody loves them and takes good care of them, whatever that means, in their own way, then that person...
As long as they're happy.
Exactly. The fact that they're happy means the most to me. But I do have expectations, and I would be lying if I said that I didn't have expectations. And I think, for me, one of the expectations is that this person is a strong woman in the world or has the potential for being. So I wouldn't understand a daughter-in-law who just stayed at home and didn't work outside the home. But yeah. I guess, again, that's, you know, quite idiosyncratic. And obviously, if that's what she chose to do and my son was happy with that, that's what I would like. But I would prefer a daughter-in-law who has a career and likes to work, because I would be able to relate better to this kind of person.
My God, do you know what? There's probably a reason why your son's not married yet, because you've set the benchmark so high as a mother that how on earth is someone meant to, you know, sort of not compete, but you've just set the benchmark really high. So, yeah, I'd be really worried if I was him.
No, that's so sweet and that's so kind. And I do think, but I do understand what you're saying. And I do think that that could be its own kind of pressure. So that's why it's probably a good idea for my son and daughter-in-law when she comes along to be living separately from me. Yeah. Because, you know, there is always that tension. Yeah. But, you know, to be a strong woman, to be a woman in the world. And I guess my last expectation is to be, even if she doesn't like me or like the rest of my family, like us, to be polite, to be respectful, to be civil. But I guess that's every in-law's expectation. That's quite a basic, normal expectation, isn't it? To be well-mannered.
We say it's basic, but a lot of people completely forget their manners sometimes.
And yeah. I think it would be the only thing that I wouldn't be able to stand in a daughter-in-law, you know, not being civil, not being respectful, not being polite. And I think especially in young women, it's quite off-putting. I mean, it's off-putting in anybody, but especially in young women, you know.
Yeah.
So to just be helpful around the house when they come over, you know, just be respectful and polite and helpful. And that's about it. No other expectations. I'm hoping that, you know, I adore my daughter-in-law when she comes. I'm sure I will.
Yeah.
If she meets these few criteria, I'm sure I'll absolutely adore her.
Oh, amazing. Well, I'm going to be keeping my eyes peeled and, and hope that I see a wedding at some point, and I want to catch up with you and know what's going on. But I'd love to know, I've got two last questions for you, and then we've got a quick word association game. So one of the questions is, what is one best piece of advice for anyone that is struggling to deal with their in-laws? If you had just one thing to say to them.
I would actually say, remember that you're going to be an in-law yourself someday. And this is, you know, I wish I had thought of that when I was a young daughter-in-law and sometimes didn't see things from my mother-in-law's point of view or my sister's-in-law point of view. And now the clock has sort of moved on and it'll be my turn to be a mum-in-law. And, you know, it's just important to remember that actually this is part of, you know, an ongoing story. So it's something about always being able to see things from someone else's point of view. I think that a lot of the time in families, we get so caught up with our own viewpoint and we just sort of can't shift that because we think it's so right. But if we take a slightly different perspective, like for you thinking about your sister-in-law and maybe just thinking, oh my gosh, what might it be like for her coming into a different home?
Definitely.
And then, you know, does she want to share something with someone? So it's about empathy, I guess, being able to put yourself in someone else's shoes and just see the world from their point of view. And so with your in-laws, just remember that, you know, your turn will come too. And how would you like to be treated at that point? So just really to be able to imagine their world and their experience.
I love that advice, but it just makes me think of the mother-in-laws that aren't so nice or aren't so friendly and quite cruel. And I just think you too were a daughter-in-law at one point and you too weren't treated, you know, the best, or you probably didn't have a great experience. So it's quite heartbreaking that you've continued to, you know, you're then treating the next generation of women in a way that you didn't particularly like.
I absolutely agree. And maybe I'm just being far too idealistic here or thinking about, you know, the good mums-in-law. And I agree that there are lots who are cruel and who are, you know, unreachable as well. Yes. So a lot of my advice about building bridges, it's only if it's possible for the mother-in-law to, you know, meet somebody halfway. Yeah. And I think that, you know, I think for those who have mothers-in-law who are really difficult and really demanding and very possessive, I think my main advice would be just to actually draw the boundaries very firmly and clearly, as I've said, and get your husband on your side to support you. And actually, without his support and without him fighting this battle for you on your behalf, there's not much that can be achieved. So a lot of that work has to be done through one's husband, through one's partner.
As a team.
As a team, exactly. And, you know, if necessary, don't hesitate to seek professional help would be the other advice I'd give. And
yes.
I should be surprised if you say to your husband that, you know, this is something that we have to do together, because this situation, without blaming them or attacking them or the in-laws, because actually everyone feels loyal to their family, even if they're, you know, terrible families. And we hate to hear our parents being criticized, especially for an outsider. So I think the worst kind of thing that you can do is just be really critical of your in-laws, because it's really hard for the husbands who feel terribly torn. But to get them on your side, if you say, look, I'm really struggling, and, you know, I know that your mum-in-law has got your mum has got your best interests at heart, and I'm sure she's a wonderful woman, but I'm just really struggling in the relationship and I need your help. I need you to support me and protect me. And can we think about this together? And if we can't do it, just the two of us, can we go and talk to a professional, even for a couple of sessions, and try and get that person to help us to see how we can work as a team to have a better relationship with your mum or with your sister, you know? So that's how I would couch it. I hope that people would see that. And, you know, I hope that husbands would actually, I'm sure they would, because nobody wants constant conflict in their homes.
No, because it's just going to end up building more tension in your own actual, like, relationship as a couple if your partner is constantly upset and, you know.
Exactly. And sometimes, actually, in my experience, husbands don't agree. And then I'll just say to the wife, well, look, let's have a few sessions anyway, just to think about this issue. And as long as your husband's aware that this is what you're doing, and that, you know, from time to time, I might give you some messages to take back to him. Because sometimes I work in a very indirect way, as one has to, because, as you said, lots of South Asian men really don't like the idea of therapy, but they don't mind if they can see that their wives are really troubled. They'll understand the need that she has someone to talk to, and then, you know, that's another way around it. So I guess my piece of advice is don't hesitate to seek professional help if you need to, because some of these issues are really quite complicated and quite entrenched. So someone can help you just to disentangle some of them and to create better and warmer relationships.
Absolutely. And I think it does really help when you've just got an outside perspective, because when you're sitting in it and you just feel like everything is bubbling up, everything is playing on your mind 10 times. Like, you know, you go in the shower and you're repeating conversations in your own head, or I should have said this and I should have said that. You're never going to get anywhere.
I think that's absolutely right. And I think that, you know, the other problem is that you don't want to go to people who might know your family, who might know your in-laws, who know your husband.
People talk.
And especially in our community, I think there is a lot of gossip and there is a lot of stigma, or can be.
Exactly. Well, that's why we're doing this podcast, because that's exactly the problem. my last question for you is, what message would you send to the talking aunties or family members that are putting pressure on young girls or guys that are just trying to live their best lives?
I think I would just urge them to give these young people a chance, you know, back off a little bit. Don't pressurize them. This is the future generation. If you have good relationships with the next generation, they're going to be really kind to you. You know, yes, I would really just urge them to cut them some slack, to be kind, you know, to be nurturing, to be gentle, and don't expect them to be like you, because they were brought up in a completely different time. This is a completely different generation. So, you know, allow them some time to sort of learn how to do things in the way in which you would like them to do things. And that actually, if you do want to teach daughters-in-law or young women about how you would like things to be, you have to do it with gentleness. You have to do it with love. You know, you have to do it by being alongside them.
Yeah, holding their hand rather than dragging.
That's right. Yeah.
Yeah, that's a great message.
And I think the other thing I would like to say, though, is I think for women of my generation, it's important to recognize that you do actually have to stop competing with younger women, to allow them now to be the ones who will carry things forward. So it's no point trying to cling on to things that you haven't done in your lifetime, or things that you haven't had, and to feel at all resentful.
Yes.
Or insecure of younger women, but rather to appreciate them and to value everything that they bring, because we need the energy of younger women.
Yes, and there's so much that we could learn from each other if we just work together, rather than there being this huge gap between the older generation of women and younger generation. And, you know, I learned so much from, you know, my mum or my aunties, just from even funny little stories or little memories or things that they say that they did when they were younger. And, you know, you can form such lovely connections and things like that, rather than it being a rivalry.
It doesn't have to be competitive. Exactly. I guess that would be my main message. You know, you don't have to compete with younger women. You can actually learn from them, value them, appreciate them, and feel valued by them, you know, feel admired. And so instead of feeling insecure, it's quite good to actually have a collaboration.
Yes. Definitely. I love that. I love that. That's such a great message. We're going to play a quick word association game. So it's really quick, I promise you. I'm going to say a word and you're going to say the first word that comes to your mind. Okay. Ready?
Uh-huh.
Okay. First one is aunties.
Support.
Burfi.
Yummy.
Weddings.
Fun.
Swear word. My mum would make the same noise. Money.
Vitally important for couple relationships, couple and family relationships.
That's really interesting. Makeup.
Has its uses.
Family.
Belonging.
Chai.
Not to meet her, please.
Oh. Dogs.
I'm not sure why young people are so obsessed with dogs.
What? And coronavirus.
Uncertainty.
Yeah, that's a good word. Yay! You did a great job. Really, could you tell us like what any of your future plans are? You've done so much, you've achieved so many things, and it's been so amazing talking to you. But yeah, do you have anything coming up? Are you working on anything? And just in general, where can people find you? How can they get in touch with you? Because obviously there are tons of people that would probably need your help and support. So I'd love for them to be able to reach you.
Oh, that's brilliant. So at the moment, I'm really focusing on my clinical practice, you know, which is growing. Until quite recently, I was the CEO of the Association of Family Therapy until last December. And I've now stopped doing that and given that up. I'm also not writing a book at this point. And I just really want to devote myself to being with clients, talking to people, learning from them, learning from their stories, and then seeing what happens in that space. Yeah. I'm also very keen on more of these sorts of opportunities to be in the media, to reach out to a larger audience, you know. So thank you for inviting me to do this. It's brilliant. So it's really, I'm focusing right now, and especially my work with intercultural couples, I find fascinating. I know that's not today's topic.
No.
I do think it's really, really interesting, and I want to develop that further too. So really, at this stage of my life, I think I'm focusing more on my clinical practice than on anything else. And I can be found I also do teaching, some in Singapore, some in other countries. And that's fun too. And that's fun to do on Zoom. But that's about it. No huge plans. I actually, for a change, I just want to see what develops.
They still sound like huge plans to me, if I'm honest with you.
And again, like, I guess focusing on my own family as well, which is lovely. I, you know, so people can find me. I hope they do find me. I've got a website. It's www.renisingh.com. And it's, my name is spelled with four E's for some reason. So it's R-E-E-N-E-E. And if people Google me, that'll come up too. I'm based at the Child and Family Practice in Bloomsbury in London, so they can find me through there. I have a Twitter account, which will come up as well if they Google me. So I hope that, you know, people do reach out. I'd love to hear from folk about any issue that they're struggling with their families, with their couple relationships.
Yeah, get in touch. Huge.
Yeah, get in touch. Therapy is not something that's, you know, only for those who are really distressed. It could be for everybody. It's just a really a way of improving one's couple and family relationships. So I do hope that people find me and reach out to me.
Yes, definitely. And I would definitely encourage anyone to to try therapy even before you step into marriage and before you step into, you know, moving in with in-laws or anything, because yeah, you might find out some things about your relationship, your partner or that family just through therapy, and it could change things or it might make things better. So yeah, I think it's really, really valuable. So thank you so much for all your teachings today and like a great conversation. I'm sure so many people are going to find this really, really helpful. And I know that if I ever get married one day, I will be taking on your advice.
That's so sweet. Thank you. And, you know, I'd love to hear more about your experiences. Well, maybe not today, but sometime, you know, because you've done amazing things. I really like what I've seen of your work.
Oh,
and, you know, I just want to find out more and see if there are any opportunities to work together in the future. But it's just been such a pleasure. I've just really, really enjoyed talking to you. And I think it's such a good way in which our conversation kind of developed that reflects the theme of, you know, aunties and really, you know, what wisdom we as aunties can give the younger generation. And
yeah, it's so interesting.
And in turn, what we can learn from, you know, women your age. So I have huge admiration for your work and, you know, I'm really happy to have been a part of this.
Thank you. No, I really, really appreciate you making the time today.
Thank you so much, Dr. Rini, for all your wise words in today's episode. It was so insightful talking with you. I really hope you enjoyed our conversation today, and I'd love to hear your thoughts over on the What Would the Auntie Say Instagram page. Don't forget, you can now pre-order a signed copy of What Would the Auntie Say, the book, on Waterstones and WH Smith's. If you're listening on the Entel app, there will be direct links to where you can purchase, as well as links to anything else we spoke about today. Lastly, please subscribe to the podcast, rate and review. It really does help your girl out. And thank you so much for listening. I can't wait for you to join me on the next one.